Hello, everyone, and welcome to the forum brought to you by the Institute on Science for Global Policy. I'm Barbara, and I'm here with my lovely co-hosts, Aubrey and Cleo. But we would love to have you be a part of the action. Tweet us at ISGP Forum with hashtag ISGP Forum and join the discussion. And also make sure to like us on Facebook and join the discussion there. You can find us on Facebook at ISGP's The Forum.
Today, we're going to hop back across the pond to the UK. Speaking of, shout out to our last podcast episode that discussed a debate that took place in the UK, episode 5 called Genetic Modification Deliberation. While that debate happened in London, the debate we'll be talking about today took place in Edinburgh, Scotland, at the University of Edinburgh.
Ah, Edinburgh, still the Scottish roots of my heart. This Signature Series conference took place on October 23rd through 26, 2011, and was called Emerging and Persistent Infectious Diseases, Focus on Mitigation.
The paper we'll talk about was titled Innovation, Policy, and Public Interactions in the Management of Infectious Diseases. It was written by Professor Joyce Tate, who works at the Inogen Center within the University of Edinburgh.
As always, you can find the paper online at the ISGP website under the Publications tab. Dr. Tate's paper and debate focused on influenza and how to plan and prepare for future flu pandemics.
Maybe we should give a quick recap of some definitions before we move on.
Good idea. Let's start small, microscopic even. Today we'll be talking about the avian flu, or H5N1, and the swine flu, H1N1. Those names that you hear for different flus, such as H1N1, refer to the compositions of hemagglutinin and neuraminidase proteins on the flu's virus's surface. There are several types of H and N, which make each strain of the flu unique. This, of course, is one of the many reasons why treating people with the flu can be difficult.
Going bigger scale, pandemic flus are specific outbreaks that affect multiple countries. Because of this, pandemic flus need widespread preparation. For example, national and international health authorities have been developing preparedness plans for the H5N1 threat since, well, before 2005. This is because H5N1 is not something to be messed with.
No, it really isn't. H5N1, while rarely transmitted to humans, has a very high CFR, or case fatality rate. This means that if it mutated in such a way that it let it infect humans more often, it could cause a global pandemic of potentially devastating proportions. However, there is a bright side to preparing for such scary possibilities. We saw it in 2009 when the unexpected emergence of H1N1, or swine flu, encountered a generally well-prepared world population. Well-prepared, that is, due to the efforts of these same agencies.
Talk about a random happenstance.
It's not all sunshine and daisies in the world of pandemic preparedness, though. True. Dr. Tate noticed some flaws in how the UK government handles preparedness planning, the biggest one being the dichotomy between asking people to partake in social distancing, even going as far as shutting down schools, while also asking people to continue working and acting like business as usual. Stay away from everyone. But continue to do everything that you would normally do?
So the hermits who work at home and shop only online will be fine?
Basically. And the debaters agreed with Dr. Tate that this ambiguity causes public confusion. But it's more serious than that. Because of these contradicting views, even though the health officials were prepared for H1N1, the public was not. There was a panic in the early days of the pandemic because people didn't know how deadly the swine flu could be. The streets were filled with the panicked buying of drugs and stockpiling of face masks and healthy people socially distancing themselves. So I guess it's actually more accurate to say that the streets were simply empty. Either way, there was also considerable controversy and confusion around decisions to close some schools. And while a little time would show the world that the swine flu wasn't any more deadly than the typical winter flu, the outbreak immediately showed how ill-prepared we are to face a pandemic flu that is more deadly.
It gets even worse when taking into account the economic impact of pandemic flus. In her paper, Dr. Tate discussed how economic and epidemiological modeling have been used to propose a few different scenarios with varying degrees of flu severity, vaccine efficacy, and other variables. The outcome? Staggering.
For a less severe or low fatality scenario, the cost could range from 8.4 billion to 16.8 billion pounds. That's 12.6 billion or 25.2 billion US dollars.
And that's the low end of the range? What's the high?
For high fatality scenarios, the cost to the GDP is 55.5 billion to 72.3 billion pounds, or 83.2 billion to 108.5 billion US dollars.
Wow, that is not some pocket change.
No, it's really not. And Dr. Tate said that accounting for social distancing exacerbated these numbers, which makes sense. Less people working, shopping, etc. means less money moving about.
The debaters discussed this as well. Convincing people to stay home when sick is problematic, especially because many people do not get paid when they are absent from work, no matter the reason.
But Dr. Tate also added that vaccine development and production could reverse those numbers. Not only would it obviously prevent the illness from spreading, but it would also reassure the public and reduce the amount of social distancing.
Speaking of vaccines, during the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, the debaters noted that vaccine distribution and utilization was a success. The vaccine was developed and available in just 5 months. Additionally, hospitals mandated vaccines for healthcare providers, and specifically in the U.S., the vaccine was rapidly distributed to places like schools.
But didn't the debaters also identify some pretty big problems with vaccine distribution during the H1N1 pandemic?
Negative Nancy strikes again!
What? It's an honest question.
And she's right, you know. The debaters were critical of a few major ways in which mitigation efforts were handled.
Ha!
Namely, the debaters stated that the government response was not scaled appropriately, and critical parts of the infrastructure needed for vaccination and treatment weren't given high priority. These failings were attributed in part to the fact that mitigation planning was based too heavily on 1918 influenza pandemic scenarios.
1918. Isn't that the Spanish flu?
Yep.
You mean they based the infrastructure on a flu pandemic that occurred before the first flu vaccine was even made?
Yep.
I'm not sure how to handle that information.
To add insult to injury, debaters also proposed that the only reason mitigation appeared to be so successful was because the mortality rate was so low for H1N1. If it had been higher, it's possible that the infrastructure systems would have broken down and the mitigation efforts would have failed.
So, the system is archaic. What can be done?
Well, Dr. Tate pointed out in her paper that this is a very strong argument for the faster development of vaccines.
Dr. Tate states that synthetic biology can play a big role in this effort. New developments could possibly do anything from pinpointing specific human antibodies for faster diagnosis to making vaccines that have synthetically weakened versions of the virus for better immune response.
And all of these developments, in her opinion, need to make vaccines available much more rapidly, particularly in pandemic situations.
The debaters weren't so sure about this, though. Especially regarding how quickly a vaccine could actually be produced and distributed in the event of a pandemic. More specifically, they weren't sure if just speeding up the biological creation would help, since there's so much more involved in making sure people have access.
It's possible to fast-track vaccine approval. Look at the European Commission and European Medicines Agency's fast response in partnership with groups like the WHO. To the 2009 H1N1 outbreak. But even in cases where vaccines were fast-tracked, there are still quite a few additional hurdles.
The biggest hurdle being bulk manufacturing on a commercial scale. The debaters questioned whether the limiting factor behind speeding up production was biological, or if political and economic factors also came into play.
Even if it were scientifically feasible to make vaccines faster, it might be hard to persuade pharmaceutical companies to do so if they're not sure how, and if, governments are going to foot the bill.
Sounds like they're afraid of a dine and dash situation.
Develop and dash?
Vaccinate and vamos?
All right, you two.
Well, the debaters suggested that current regulatory systems could incentivize fast development of vaccines.
They brought up a specific example in which the state of California regulated the emissions of cars being sold in-state. Car manufacturers thought it was impossible, but within 5 years, the market was there, and the change was exceedingly easy. So there you have it, emissions to influenza.
However, before we get ahead of ourselves, the debate didn't provide any specific ways this could be applied to vaccines.
In addition to more rapid vaccine development, is there anything else that can be done to slow down or stop the spread of potential pandemics?
That's where things get heated. Remember how Dr. Tate felt about social distancing?
You mean the economic impacts of people just stopping what they're doing to avoid illness?
Exactly that. The debaters' opinions were all over the place when it came to social distancing, mostly because the jury is still out on whether or not it's effective in combating pandemic flus.
Isn't this pretty straightforward, though? I mean, if you're not given the opportunity to be around someone with the flu, then you'd be less likely to catch it, right?
Well, in reality, the confusion starts with research. Studies have concluded that it works and that it doesn't work.
That doesn't seem very helpful.
So there's team social distancing doesn't work and team social distancing totally works.
Well, this isn't a young adult novel about vampires, but yes. There's also conflicting evidence regarding school closures.
Studies done in Canada, France, and Japan have suggested that school closure is effective at preventing disease spread, but other studies have shown that these closings have little impact. In fact, it was argued that the decrease in flu transmission seen in summer months didn't have anything to do with school not being in session, but rather it was because flu season happens in the winter.
Also, while students might not be in school, they might be in other public places, which completely defeats the purpose of shutting the schools down.
But what else is there to do? When schools are shut down, families who don't have childcare for whatever reason are left with two options. Take the day off and not make money, or celebrate an impromptu take-your-child-to-work day.
The gender norm for women in the workplace means they're typically the ones that have to make this tough decision, though.
And look at gender statistics of the workers at healthcare facilities. Healthcare workers are predominantly female, so this could feasibly impact the ability for healthcare facilities to address pandemics.
So it sounds like school closures add more variables to the flu pandemic equation rather than removing them.
There are even more variables, though. The effectiveness of school closures may depend on the fatality rates of the flu in question. A high fatality rate might just convince parents to keep their children at home while also keeping them from associating with their friends and peers.
No kidding. If I were a parent, I don't think I would take the risk. Even if it wasn't an immediate threat, I'd probably still stock up on food and ready my Netflix.
The debaters referred to this as a runaway precautionary social distancing problem, aka the fact that if social distancing is shown to be effective in an outbreak, it's going to occur more, which will result in even more social disruption.
The debaters saw runaway precautionary social distancing as something that would induce a chain reaction. Supermarket shelves may empty, bank cash dispensing machines may not be serviced, and transportation systems may break down.
But where is the line drawn? If I'm a healthcare worker, am I allowed to partake in social distancing?
It's not well understood who should and shouldn't continue working during flu pandemics, and research needs to be done in these areas.
But that still begs the question, does social distancing work? Does it not work? Is it worth it?
Understandably, there is a lot of confusion regarding social distancing. What started with confusion stemming from conflicting studies, as well as public health myths, is now full-blown ambiguity in national contingency plans for influenza outbreaks.
While much of our debate focused on the implications of school closures and playing hooky from work, debaters did raise the point that global policy related to social distancing needs to be addressed. It can be a very complex problem. I mean, for example, what do you do with passengers on a plane who have just come from a country where a pandemic flu is present? Social distancing in an international context can quite quickly lead to travel and trade restrictions.
Also, social class plays a role in how well social distancing can work in a country. For example, the average U.S. worker is typically a non-salaried hourly worker. In fact, it's not uncommon for people at all levels to be hourly workers with no holiday time, sick leave, or time off at all for that matter. How can you ask someone to not come into work when that pay might be the only way he or she can get food on the table?
As of the time of this debate, there was no policy in place protecting non-salaried workers from missing work due to illness, specifically pandemic flu.
All in all, a balance needs to be met. Policymakers must identify an exact point during a flu pandemic when they switch from telling people to keep calm and carry on to when they advise the public to partake in social distancing. This point would be fluid, depending on how fatal the specific flu strain is.
Do you have any thoughts on social distancing? Tweet us using hashtag ISGPForum.
We should note that confusion and ambiguity doesn't just surround social distancing, but other mitigation and prevention measures as well. For example, take the face mask.
I'm sure everyone has a picture in their mind, maybe from the news or online, of crowds of people wearing masks in hope of avoiding illness. However, there is conflicting evidence about whether or not mask use is an effective way to prevent infection, or if it's just a fashionable accessory. For example, some British research showed that face masks are not effective for stopping flu transmission, while Japanese data shows otherwise. Differences in efficacy may be due to the type of face mask, societal expectations, or other factors.
In the end, it might come down to which mask someone can afford, or just a lack of communication and education over which masks are or are not effective. Face masks purchased over-the-counter at pharmacies were said to be ineffective, and the effective antiviral masks were said to be expensive. These sorts of differences are often not communicated to the public.
On top of that, in the UK, the public was told that face masks were not effective, so face masks weren't made widely available. Simultaneously, face masks were made available to healthcare workers regularly exposed to the infection.
Talk about mixed signals.
But also consider being a UK citizen and watching the news and seeing citizens of different countries wearing masks. These sorts of things not only cause confusion, but also cause alarm and suspicion.
So first and foremost, governments need to strive to actively communicate with the public.
Dr. Tate did agree that communication was important to pandemic mitigation, stating in her paper that a plan must be developed that not only takes into account the views of those who will be implementing the plan, but also considers the socioeconomic outcomes. In addition, it must integrate regional and local governments and delineate clear responsibilities regarding who is in charge of what.
The debaters felt that the media, as well as public health officials, must be proactively incorporated into pandemic planning and mitigation. In fact, this communication with the public must occur before a pandemic even begins.
While it might be hard to get the public to pay attention to these pre-pandemic communications, it is nevertheless still important that the public is educated before crisis strikes.
And since research is ever evolving and ever changing, public health officials must find a way to communicate new information without causing distrust.
Speaking of public distrust, the debater cited several examples of how mistrust has occurred in past health situations. In one incident, a group of physicians chose not to be vaccinated because they believed the vaccine could be harmful to them. In another, a country gave politicians and members of the army a different type of influenza vaccine than the one that was offered to the general public. Although the government employees only received these vaccines because of a contract issue, it caused a great deal of mistrust and suspicion in the public.
Understandably so. This ambiguity, in addition to mixed messages from officials, is enough to make anyone question what they should and should not do. So, how can this be remedied?
The debaters felt that contingency plans must be crafted in order to counter distrust of public health agencies or international organizations.
Obviously, moving forward, a major part of preparing for flu pandemics is communication and education.
And developing better science so that these pandemics can be stopped sooner.
There were questions regarding whether medical interventions, like vaccines, were better than non-medical approaches, like masks and social distancing, or whether they were complementary.
In general, it was thought that non-medical approaches could buy more time for medical approaches to be implemented. If social distancing and masks do slow the spread, they should be used.
And by no means is there a singular solution for approaching pandemic mitigation. The specific combination of non-medical and medical approaches used must be country-specific, society-specific, and disease-specific.
What are your thoughts on how the world prepares for flu pandemics? Is social distancing helpful or harmful, considering the economic impacts? How can health officials better communicate with the public? Be sure to tweet your comments to us at ISGPForum with hashtag ISGPForum.
Also, like us on Facebook at ISGP's The Forum.
If you're interested in this topic, be sure to give a listen to episodes 4 and 7 of the show, entitled Flu Fighters and Fever Fortune Tellers, respectively.
What can I say? We're flu fanatics.
Well, it is an important issue today in science policy.
Couldn't agree more. Well, thank you for socializing with science today. Hope to have you back next time here on the Forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.